Desi, noun, a person of Indian, Pakistani, Bangladeshi, Nepali, or Sri Lankan origin who lives abroad.
American Desi. Well, that's what we hope to discover here. What's up, guys? Welcome to this week's episode. I'm Akash.
I'm Arjun.
And today we have a very special guest. I'm super excited. We have America's first cool Indian.
That makes me feel really old.
Oh, I think we just got cool. So okay. I didn't even mean it like that. But please welcome to the show, DJ Rekha.
Hi, how you doing, guys?
Thank you for being here.
My pleasure. Well, you're being here. You're actually in my apartment.
Yeah, we're in your apartment. This is the first famous person's apartment I've ever been in. So I'm excited about that.
Do not reveal the location. I need my anonymity.
I got the fact that you need anonymity. I could give my address out right now. Nobody coming over. This is going to be one of the few times I'm going to probably not be super obnoxious on the podcast because I'm just not the coolest person in the room. I feel like with Arjun, it's no problem. Whatever. He's stupid.
That's true.
let's jump right into it. You are credited with making Bhangra popular in America, which is crazy.
Pretty crazy. Who said that?
Wikipedia said that.
So. Wikipedia says that about
you. Wrote
that.
And I never thought about that. I never thought about the fact that before I started seeing DJ Rekha's name, I didn't really see anything about Bhangra anywhere. So how do you feel about that?
Well, I think I'm one of the forces, perhaps, or one of the things that helped popularize Bhangra in a very particular way. I think there are other things that happen in tandem or preceding me. One is Bhangra Blood in Washington, D.C., which is actually older than Based on Bhangra by a few years, which is an intercollegiate dance competition.
Okay.
Right.
That started out as a school event. It blew up to a huge 4,000 seat sold out competition.
Wow.
Right.
And it's probably the first competition of its kind and has since spawned many copycat competitions and out of the college space as well. I think that there are other things that have been happening in South Asian culture that have allowed for more cultural awareness at large. I think if you take Bhangra as an idea or the kind of stuff I do, which is, sparked by doing this party based on Bhangra, that's just one thing. And whenever you're talking about culture, there's so many different ways to access it and so many different audiences. I definitely was at the right place at the right time, at a moment where the South Asian community was becoming, coming of age culturally, politically, et cetera, that, were part of this story in some way.
Now, Basement Bhangra is a big part of why people think that about you.
Yes.
How long ago did you start Basement Bhangra?
Well, next month.
I'm sorry, real quick. Sure. For people who don't know what it is, we're listening.
Oh,
right.
Would you mind explaining it?
Right. So Basement Bhangra is a monthly party that I started 18 years ago.
Wow.
Really?
Yeah, you guys were in diapers.
Not that young.
Maybe diapers. Yeah. Maybe, maybe not diapers, but definitely in your grade school years at least. It started in 1997.
Wow.
And I had no idea that this would be my life or a very major part of my life. So yeah, it started out as we did one event. It happened to be with Bally Sagu.
Yeah.
Good timing. Bally Sagu is a producer, also known as a DJ from the UK, who pioneered, I would say, fusing Bhangra and other South Asian sounds. He has a great album he did with Nusrat Fateh Ali Khan too, called Star Rise is the album he did with Nusrat. And I was influenced by that as a teenager, and he happened to at that moment signed an international deal. He was in town, and we got him for the gig, and that really helped get a lot of people in the door that night. And one thing led to another, and it just kept going.
Has it always been at SOBs?
It's not at SOBs.
It's not at SOBs anymore.
No. Guys, you got to do some basic research before you talk to me.
That's true.
You know? It's not at SOBs. I was at SOBs for 15 years, and I'm at Le Poisson Rouge right now. Okay. It's still the first Thursday.
All right.
You can edit out that shit.
Nah, no, well, we're happy
just
to
take
get
that
schooled.
L. It's all good.
We're happy to get schooled.
Yeah.
Well, now I'm embarrassed to ask a question. Akash, you want to go back? I feel like I'm back
yeah,
in
school. Yeah, how did you...
back in school?
So you
back
said
in
you school. Had, you said you had no idea this would be what your life became. What were you doing at the time? Were you always interested in music? Like,
well, at the time, I was still in college, though past my college graduating years. I was working... actually, I was working my first, like... Maybe I just finished college or something like that. I don't... it's vague. I was hustling. I was like working different day jobs, not really like passionate about them. I was DJing prior to starting Basement, but my cousins had just left for India. We had started together as sort of like a DJ crew. We did private events, whatever came our way. And I was just a couple of years into the emerging like South Asian party scene. It was very new. It was, again, the first time there was a formidable like critical mass of people. But prior to that, Desi Kids would have college parties that were once or twice a semester per school, or we'd go to the West Indian clubs in South Queens that were well established. So, I was DJing, but it was not a vocation. It was not a main thing. And I was working, and I was just trying to make rent and trying to figure things out. And this thing just kind of slowly took off. It was very organic. And I started Basement in early, 1997. And by the end of the year, I launched another party called Mutiny. So they kind of started almost at the same time. Mutiny started like later on in the year. Again, it was started as a fundraiser for Vivek Bald's film. Vivek Bald, of course, is a professor now at MIT, but he just wrote a book, Bengalis, about Bengalis in Harlem. He's a filmmaker as well. And that party was started as a fundraiser for his film, Mutiny, but then it just also turned into a whole other thing, unexpectedly. And things just sort of evolved, and that was a very interesting time in New York, 1997. I actually did a panel of it at NYU when I was an artist in residence. It was just a moment, like South Asian Women's Creative Collective started then. I think it was around the same time South Asian Journalists Association started. Some other things were happening at the same time in the cultural and somewhat political space.
Now, you talk a lot about, you grew up mainly in New York.
Yes.
And we grew up, I mean, he grew up in Dallas, I grew up in Tampa.
Right.
And so the Indian scene was very different than it would have been, obviously, in a very urban environment.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I'd wonder if you could speak a little bit about what it was like. Because we had small, it was dominated by families.
Sure.
And so, like, our generation, we didn't really explore having parties by ourselves because we were kids also, and we didn't really mm-hmm. have, like, what you were talking about, the West Indian clubs could go mm-hmm. to. That's really fascinating to me because...
Well, I mean, there's a huge West Indian population in Florida now.
No, but like back when I was growing up in like mm-hmm. the early 90s.
I didn't even think I knew West Indian was a thing growing up in Texas.
Mm-hmm.
Like you told me you're Trinidadian, I'd be like, you the only one in America. I mean, that's you.
That's Texas thinking, isn't it?
We know what we know. We know Mexicans. We know us.
How big a difference has it been now? It's 2015.
I mean, we came here as immigrants and we stick close to what you know. There's definitely like numbers. And I just think things started, we found like-minded people at some point. My upbringing was, I grew up in a suburb in Long Island that was not Indian at all.
Really?
And it's a little atypical in that the politics of Long Island are dictated by real estate and class, and real estate dictates class. So where there's more property taxes, there's, quote, better schools on the paper, and those areas are not, those are not folks of color mostly.
Right.
And South Asians and other, like, East Asians and, Persians gravitate, towards those areas for economic betterment or, like, whatever. So my parents happened to move into a neighborhood that they liked the house. They liked the location. and they thought, they heard the schools were iffy. And of course, I learned later what that meant. That was just code, you know?
Yeah.
They learned the schools were iffy, and they thought, oh, whatever, we'll send our kids to private school. My father cockily said that before his, he realized, like, that was, like, a little bit of a steep commitment.
Yeah.
And so we did go to a parochial school for, like, I went for 1 year. My sister went for 2 years. She's 3 years older. And the idea in that town was get to the high school. The high school's cool. The junior high is scary. And I just think junior highs are scary. It doesn't matter where you are.
Yeah.
Right.
Now, the junior high, the high school of the public high school?
Yeah, or the public high school.
Was cool. Gotcha.
Right. So I ended up in the public school system in that town. And it was the best thing. It was the best decision my parents ever made that they didn't realize. Like, I was just in a really mixed community of folks.
Right.
And I was around a lot of Caribbean, second-gen Caribbean immigrants. It was mostly African-American. And it was a mix. It was also like a strong Italian, small Italian community that mostly went to the private school, except kids that couldn't afford to go to the private school went to the public school. So we had a little range, but there weren't actually, there were hardly any South Asians. In fact, I could count them on one hand.
Right.
And it was very funny. The funniest thing about my grade was there was one other South Asian, Linda Thomas. She was Malayali. She lived on the same block as me. You think about that.
Right.
What are the chances that there's two Desis and we live on the same street?
Wow.
Yeah. In my grade, anyway. So, but of course, at home and in our family life, my parents only socialized with people from, like, West Delhi. Like, it was very specific. So I went to, when I went to college, I met a lot of South Asians my age. I didn't really have any. I went to Queens College.
Gotcha.
The other thing about my parents' social circle was my mom was a nurse, and a lot of their friends growing up, though it's changed, were my parents' was my mom's nursing students. So they were older in that circle, so their kids were younger. And at that time, those kids didn't feel like my peers. They were 4 and 5 years younger than me. Now we're actually, I've had some, you know, I have like relationships with some of those people growing up, but so I never really had Desi kids my age growing up at all.
Right.
And when I went to college, I started meeting, you know, South Asians my age. And then I got into political organizing. And then I started really meeting people that were of similar interests culturally and politically.
What type of political organizing?
Well, the
South Asian based political organizing?
Well, the thing that galvanized me, well, growing up, I listened to. I got galvanized from the radio. I love radio as a medium. I was listening to WBAI, which is part of the Pacifica Network. It's a free speech radio station. They don't take any other than listener sponsorship money. They don't take any other money. And it's a progressive left station. And I grew up in a time where there was a huge fight against apartheid and divestments in South Africa. And growing up in a predominantly African-American community, these things were very, very live. A lot of our teachers were part of the civil rights struggle. And when Black History Month came around, there was a real emphasis on learning about that. And again, I just think I was very fortunate. And I just don't think that most kids who are immigrant get to grow up, you know, exposed to that kind of cultural background. So, so in terms of organizing work, in 87... there were a rash of violent attacks in Jersey and against the new community there in Jersey City. And of those attacks, there were two more famous ones. One was the murder of Nofroz Modi. He was walking out of a bar in Jersey City with his white colleague, and there were racial epithets thrown at him, and he was beaten to death. His white friend was spared. That was a very, very well-publicized case, and the end result was, for the most part, I think the people got off, or there was some civil rights, thing. But, you know, it was a very publicized case, so much so that his parents actually moved out of New York because it was just too crazy for them. The second case, which was not as well publicized, was a case of Dr. Khosrow Shirin. He was beaten in front of a fire station in Jersey City and left for dead in front of a fire station. Across from a park where a lot of, you know, young kids would hang out, white kids, whatever. So this case was coming up to civil, to the, you know, the criminal case didn't happen or didn't go anywhere, and the civil case was up. And so there were some people organizing, trying to pack the court. And at that time, I had, there was a professor who's still at Queens College who I developed quite a close relationship with, because, you know, we had a lot of love for Flushing and Queens. And she actually wrote a book, I think, Indians in Flushing, or eventually that was. But she, somewhere how through the networks, we learned about this case, that people were going to the court to pack the court. Asian American Legal Defense Fund was representing Dr. Sharon. And we went there, and then I met these other people. They were a little bit older than me, but they were like young South Asian civil rights lawyers. And I was like, what? You could do that? Like,
right.
And it kind of blew my mind. And then I just, they had an organization that they had started when they were in college called YAR, Youth Against Racism. They eventually stopped calling it Youth Against Racism because they felt they were older. But that was sort of the beginning for me. I met these people, and, you know, where politics is, the art is. So not only were these people committed to that stuff, there was also, like, through that, I, you know, we would, you know, hang out and socialize and do work. And then, you know, at some point I met Vivek Bald, and I met other people that, you know, others, people that were like Gayatri Gopinath, who's a scholar, and she was like just starting her PhD, and she was interested in cultural, you know, production and Bhangra, and, you know, we talked a lot, and some of what I said and what we talked about, I know eventually, you know, informed her work to some degree. And and it was just like finding like-minded people.
You talk about the political, kind of the rise of that politics and how that shaped you. And you just said that politics, where politics is arts meet.
Yeah.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, you're a DJ.
Mm-hmm.
And hip-hop, you could, the trace of hip-hop, there's a lot of that same. It comes from a response.
Mm-hmm.
Was that why that, was there an appeal to hip-hop because of that? Or did hip-hop just always grow up with you?
Well, I hip-hop grew up with me. I'm of an age where I saw hip-hop emerge.
Right.
And having lived in Long Island, very close to Queens, we were sort of like 1 or 2 degrees away from the Queens hip-hop scene.
Right.
And now when I compare the age to, like, these OG rappers, I'm like, oh, they weren't even that much older than me.
Right.
So, you know, for instance, I had a friend who had a friend that was dating LL Cool J briefly, you know, and we got his phone number and we heard his outgoing message, and it was like a rap. I remember all of us calling it just to hear the outgoing message. I mean,
That's amazing.
Like, you know, 1 or 2 degrees away, and I personally didn't go out clubbing in high school, but some of these kids did, and they would go to, I remember hearing about Latin Quarters, and even when we, you know, reached our early 20s, they would go to some of those venues and things. And I was exposed to that. And, you know, in school, everyone was like breakdancing or learning how to do, you know, one of the five elements of hip hop. So it was definitely around that.
So when did, of the five elements, DJing is where you kind of found your way. Did that happen?
Yes, I do not rhyme.
Did that kind of happen organically? How did you
It happened organically, very organically, in the sense that I grew up listening to hip-hop and, you know, Run DMC first album was very influential because it was very political.
Right.
And it's the only song from that album that people really know is Sucker MC, which is about, it's kind of like a bling song. Like, but there's a song on there called Hard Times. And there's some really, like, you know, real life stuff. And that really, like, influenced me. I really liked it. And I was very into reading and, like, words. And so that made a lot of sense to me. Where it all came together was when I started hearing, well, I first heard, like, my mom brought me a tape back. It was Mulkeet Singh. And I knew a little bit about the idea of Bhangra music. We had one record at home. We mostly grew up with Bollywood. My parents are, their background is Hindu Punjabi. So in the home, Punjabi speaking, they're from Delhi. But Hindi is a more formal language. And we had a lot of VHS tapes, like watching movies and stuff, and then, you know, I had an idea about what Bhangra was a little bit. But then my mom went to England because I was born there and they lived there for 6 years to go to a engagement party of a family friend who I consider a cousin. And this tape blew my mind. It was Upfront by Mulkeet Singh. And I just, it just fell in love with it. And I was like, wow, this music is awesome. At 16, I decided to have a Bhangra party in my parents' basement.
Wow.
And I was event producing, but I was like, I want everyone to wear Indian clothes. Now, at that time in the community here, people like want excuses to wear Indian clothes.
Right.
Even, it was very gendered where only aunties would wear saris. Now, everyone of every age, generation, and gender has some sort of Indian gear. Like, I do, sometimes these fancy events, or I'll do like whatever, and the white people have their Indian outfits, and they're not just borrowing it for the day. They are, whatever. So that was kind of funny. I had this vision then, and I insisted my dad wear something Indian, and it was very different then, because when the community starts, and I remember hearing about this in a movie about England too, where it's like originally you don't have ethnically specific items, like clothes. It's only women who kept wearing them, and then they start having men wear kurtas and stuff. It just wasn't around then. This is in the 80s. It's when I heard that music mixed in a hip hop fashion, it was basically Bali Sigu's Wham Bam 2, Wham Bam, which was like a splicing of Mulkeet Singh songs with like beats and samples and, famously in that song, it's called the Mega Mix. It's like 9 minutes long. And he goes, what do you think about Bhangra music? So what do you think about is Run from Run DMC? And then he samples Now is the Time, which is Martin Luther King. So I'm not sure where he was of the racial politics behind it, but I was like, what the hell is this?
Yeah.
This is amazing. And then some of his other stuff was very dancehall based. So he did this album called Central Raga. And I don't know. And then just one thing led to another. And my cousins lived were in the States. They were only here. They were here briefly. They were here from India. Their parents didn't like it here. So they moved back. They now live in Australia.
Wait,
so.
Can I just ask a question about that party that you had at 16? When you said the community that you invited, was it the South Asian community?
My parents' friends.
It wasn't for your friends in high school?
Yeah, no, some of my friends came in high school.
Did you insist that they wear Indian clothes also?
No, I don't think they did.
Right.
Because there was just no way.
Well, I had a question, because my sister teaches school, teaches third grade in D.C.
Yeah.
She's now teaching in Georgetown, and we talk a lot about code switching.
Mm-hmm.
Did you feel the need to code switch? Did you have to code switch between what your experience, because your experience in high school feels very different than what your experience
We code switch all the time.
Okay.
I think.
But
in what way?
Well, I'm just wondering, did you have to do it? Was there a lot of code switching? Was it like hard to navigate that for you as a kid?
I don't think so. I think I think the benefit of growing in a community of color was that I think there was less code switching, to be honest.
Okay.
I think that as I see my contemporaries who grew up in very white neighborhoods, they do that more. There's like an embarrassment around their culture. I was kind of like the native informer. I was very proud.
Okay.
So I didn't, and also because some of my friends had Caribbean backgrounds, they also were not far removed from the Indian diasporic experience. So my best friend was half Guyanese, half Bayesian, and she was Guyanese. So in her family, there were Indian people,
Right.
So like that wasn't far away, and that was actually a point of connection for us.
Because there was a lot of shame that came up with just being so different.
Right.
Growing up in that, like my community, which was very white, outside of my Indian family.
And my sister, having gone to Catholic school for 3 years, 3 or 2 years, I think, and around more white folks, I think she had more of that feeling around her. So I kind of used the Indian thing to my advantage with the teachers that were fascinated. Like, So I didn't have that experience in that way at all.
So yeah. I wanted to ask you this about the decision to do Bhangra music as a DJ. Was there anything beyond I just like this music? Or was it like, I want to introduce this music to people, to my people, anything like that?
Well, there was a very specific impetus for starting Bass and Bhangra.
And I'm sorry, one more real quick question. Did that name come from that first Bhangra party where you were like, it's going to be in my basement?
No, everyone it come didn't. Okay. Retroactively, it did. It's like, oh, actually, no. We didn't think of it. No, that name came up around when the party started.
Right.
It's just like... It made no sense. There was no basement. But no, I mean, the word basement is a take on bashment, on underground.
Right.
Ah, got it.
You know, it's a, you know, sonically bass, all that stuff. The play on all of that. The party started because at that time, me and my then DJ partner, who is now a internet superstar, like startup dude, banking guy, but is he happy? No, just kidding. Anyway, we would throw our own parties, and then we would get hired by other folks to do parties to DJ as a team. DJ, his DJ name is DJ Joy, his house name, and they would, like, promoters would straight up tell us, like, don't play Bhangra. That's like cab driver music. Or don't play too much hip hop. Now, this is a time when hip hop is not on the radio.
Right.
It's not ubiquitous. It's not considered top 40. It's considered black music. And that's it. So the opportunity to start to develop a night, I was like, I want to play the music I really like. And I did gravitate and really like it. And I then started, like, separating it out. Like, what's my fantasy? I want to hear a party with Bhangra, hip hop, and dance hall. And I want it to be for everyone. I don't want, and you know, these are parties, like the whole party scene, and even in New York, we've seen it escalate to like velvet ropes and bottle service and, you know, gender parity and all that stuff. I really wanted to create a space where it's just about dancing.
Right.
And I think the music's great. And I think even to this day, it's a space where, you know, we've been criticized sometimes too many dudes or whatever. You know, which happens at every party. If you don't do those things to regulate, you know. But I think it's a one place where, like, you know, certain South Asian men feel safe or feel welcome. Like, are they getting into the other clubs? I don't know, you know.
Right.
So basically, I mean, that's really what was the impetus was like to create, to like. And so what that says to me is when promoters were saying, don't play cab driver music and don't play hip hop music. It's a very like racist and classist directive.
Right.
It's saying we want always we want young professionals, and that's when places enforce dress codes. My parties never have dress codes ever. In fact, I did one of my other parties is Bollywood Disco, and we had a short run at this place. We did it monthly for about a few years ago, and they had this like extensive template contract, and they had all these dress code things. I go, dude, we got to nix this dress code thing. I'm not enforcing a dress code. Dress to dance, that's the code.
Well, I hear there's like a strong, from what, and correct me if I'm wrong, there's a strong activist undertone to everything that you're talking about with your events.
I don't think, it's not activist, it's social.
You wouldn't call it.
It's social justice. It's like, you know, I mean, I don't know if that's the right word, maybe. That's
okay.
What I'm struggling with. I mean, just to finish off the point about the cab driver and the black music or the hip-hop music is like the cab driver music is just a classist idea in our community, that cab driver music. That's just speaking volumes right there. Oh, excuse me.
It's all good.
Excuse me, can we pause for a minute? The definite class schism within the community around, like, you know, working class folks. And I think even in the way the community's relationship to charity. Like, it happens that there are these very elaborate fundraisers and galas for raising money for India, build schools or to help the kids. It's very much part of this savior expat complex. Right. Whereas when we try to organize and do stuff for communities here or take up issues of like domestic workers, there's like, hey, you know, we don't want to touch that, or that's not as much of an issue, you know, in the same way. Or the connections between racism and, you know, like xenophobia. And I think that when that happens, whether it's post 9/11 and sick men's turbans are being targeted,
right,
or when it's that, you know, man that got beaten in Huntsville, Alabama, the default response is differentiation.
By our community?
Yes. And I don't want to generalize how people respond, but the idea is like, oh, well, this is, we're not Muslims. Right. And here's my American flag. And we're not, oh, well, he got, you know, he was mistaken for a black male. Like, you know, there's not, you know what I'm saying? So like, that's like,
it's a way of kind
of, it's about like saying we're distinct, we're different, you know.
Well, one of the things we talk a lot about is we've experienced that we grew up in very different areas and very different,
mm-hmm,
like spaces that way.
Mm-hmm.
The South Asian community feels very fragmented to me.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering if you would agree with that, if you feel like that's different in New York, or if that feels like that's something that you struggle with or wish was different.
I mean, I don't know. I don't know what it means to be together or not together, or what, like, I think when we use the word community, it's too broad a term sometimes.
Okay.
So you say the South Asian community is fragmented. I think that, like South Asia itself, that we sort of reify parochialism a lot. So people align with their own specific ethnic strands, you know? So, like, Indian people align with, you know, we have these sort of specific conferences or whatever. It's a very particular identity politic that, like, is in place to sort of reaffirm a culture in a way, like, you know, it sort of, like, replicates the, you know, it's kind of like the way people act away from home. It's like they sort of grandize the culture they come from in a certain way. But I also think, you know, it's always problematic to use a banner like South Asian, right?
Really?
To some degree. Well, Sri Lankans don't like that word, you know, or like I use it interchangeably with Desi, and I think, like, you know, that doesn't appeal to everyone, though it's becoming more ubiquitous and kind of accepted, and language kind of transforms that way. In England, people say Asian, they don't say South Asian. I do have a problem with the word Indian American because I think that it sort of, to me, it's limited an idea, and I feel like I have more of a bond with people from the region or of the region than specifically India. And I think for me, the nation state is like the idea of India and India pride, or even American pride. Like, that's just, countries are these entities that function for very weird reasons. And we are sort of, we live in this idea of a country, but I think I'm uncomfortable with that.
So can you speak more than, so would you identify more as South Asian, or how would you?
I don't know, man. It's just like,
you identify more just as a person.
That's where code switching comes in.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, I just feel like I have so much bond with folks that I guess the word would be for me Desi, then saying Indian is exclusionary, it's hegemonic, it's not inclusive, you know. And South Asian feels more broad for me.
But I would ask about you were speaking about the conferences, and I grew up going to API a lot.
Right.
And so, but that was my parents' generation.
Yeah, and I think that.
And our generation, it sounds like every organization, when I go to schools and when we're working with USC about stuff, it's always South Asian. So that is a big shift that,
yeah,
I've seen that's happening.
Yeah, but it's lip service to an extent. It's South Asian, but it's not really diverse.
Okay.
A lot of times it's South Asian, but it's mostly Indian, or it's Indian and it's not Muslim Indian, or it's like, you know, like that's an inherent problem. Even with the Asian American organizations, they, you know, are often dominated by Chinese Americans. So, the bigger numbers. And I think that, you know, my parents are part of the Long Island Indian Association, right? But it's totally Hindu based.
Right.
It doesn't have Muslim. And I've taken my uncle, who's part of it, to task. or it doesn't, their domestic workers aren't part of that association. OPI is about physicians. It's a very, it's a certain class, you know? And I think there's, and I think the second and third generation replicate that to some extent, you know?
So they, wouldn't that speak to it being fragmented?
Yeah, I don't know. I guess why I'm like hesitant to say yes, fragmented, because I don't know why that doesn't, like, what is, when you say fragmented, it suggests to me that it should be all together and harmonious. And,
I think that's what we're,
and yeah. I'm not really sure there's, I don't know. I just.
You don't necessarily see a purpose in unifying by the region or the, like some.
Well, unifying for what? Like, I don't understand, like, well, what we're unifying.
But then on the other hand, why would you have a problem with OPI if it's.
I don't have a problem with OPI. I think OPI's. I don't have a problem with OPI.
The idea of, like, the term Indian American you don't like because it excludes people. Or
I think OPI is a very, it's a professional organization for people from a specific area, and it serves a very specific purpose.
Right. So just in general, like, you know, things don't sit well with you, like
I guess because personally, my associations culturally and politically transcend those borders of India
to,
and diaspora.
To Desi or to the world?
I have more in common with someone from Lahore than I have with someone from Chennai culturally. It's just a fact because I'm Punjabi, you
right.
know?
Right, yeah.
So I think that borders are arbitrary. But some white dude created, you know,
no, totally understand.
But when, put a line but, in the sand, and 3 million people died.
But we're talking about when we're talking about the South Asian community here. I think for me, what's important, why I long for that unify, and it might be coming from because I didn't have that space.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
Now you talk about Basement Bunger as a right. space for right. like South Asian, you know, and you were speaking specifically about South Asian men. Maybe they don't get to go into clubs and stuff like that. For me, what's really important, family is where you feel safe. And I think
for some people, not for all people, no, families aren't always safe spaces.
But the idea of the family that you create. The uh-huh. sorry,
even if
I'm
you're
using
in a
that
gang,
more.
That's your created family. You right. might not be blood related, but that's my family.
Uh-huh. So I guess one of the reasons that we feel strongly about like this desire or exploring the desire of a unified South Asian kind of community is because it would be nice to have that space.
But I mean, I think we have it. You know?
So then you would say you have.
Yeah, I do. I think I have a community of folks that are South Asian that I feel like connected with. They're not the only community I'm a part of.
Of course.
They overlap with other circles and communities and enough of one. I mean, it's hard. It's kind of like the word community and the word scene are very like, they can be slippery. They're useful sometimes, but then.
When you say scene, do you mean S-C-E-E-N-E?
Yeah,
like.
What's
like
the scene?
Like
the
Desi
scene, the party scene, the this scene.
You think those are interchangeable?
No, I think they're not interchangeable. I think they have the same kind of trappings where it's like it's not tangible and it's hard to sometimes it's being created when it's a forced creation to some extent. It's like, you know, people talk to me about the Bhangra scene. I'm like, what Bhangra scene? Like, what does that mean? Like, it's forcing. I'm like, I do a party that plays Bhangra, and I don't want to be part of a scene. So in the way community can unify people, it can also isolate people or scenes. So it's the same thing. It's like, I have often felt in part of and excluded from the community, and I feel that simultaneously all the time.
Right, and I hear what you're saying, but that everything is inherently inclusive and exclusive if we're drawing, because there have to be some borders, otherwise there are borders in place in society.
But what are those borders or whatever those sure, but like what does it mean and who and why gets excluded, you know?
That's the question, who and why gets excluded. I think the point of a South Asian, when we talk about it, mm-hmm. would be to be, and there's a reason that we're changing. I mean, and I don't know if you're mm-hmm. specifically talking about the name of our podcast. I mean, for our podcast, it was because we're both Indians, and that's where mm-hmm. it came from.
Means you don't identify as South Asians in the same way. Like, you've picked a, so you're, does that mean you're only going to interview people who are of Indian descent?
I mean, we haven't.
No, we've interviewed a bunch of people. We've interviewed people from Thailand, and we're also changing the name, which by the time yours airs, it'll probably be changed. Hopefully we're still working that out, but we did talk about that. I mean, but
that came from personal conversations of us with our identity And then, are you Indian? Are you American? How do we identify? And then we just thought it'd be a cool name. Now, me as a comedian, I just, we're trained to not be sensitive. So the idea that this could be exclusionary, that could be exclusionary, that's not, that's very rarely going to register with me. But I'm still a little, and I'm just not clear on, you identify with people from your region. Beautiful. So if we try to build a community here where people from the region, not just India, the region, can get together, that wouldn't necessarily be exclusionary to anybody outside, except people outside of the region. Isn't that a good thing? Because these are people you identify with.
I'm not saying
with.
It's a bad thing. I kind of am getting lost in this of like what you're looking for me to say to like affirm or disaffirm some thesis here.
No, it's not a thesis. No, we thesis. Just wanted to talk. You're, for us, that you, it's, you know, it's interesting because you say that you don't necessarily want to be a part of a scene, but you did help create a scene.
But what's the scene I created? What other party is like this?
Well, if you, well, it's not about the party, but if you were credited with popularizing Bhangra, and Bhangra is now a very pervasive aspect of South Asian culture,
mm-hmm.
I mean, you can't deny that that was an impact that you had. And so...
Yeah, but I think, like, when you use the word scene in terms of parties, you, there's the... To me, the implication is there are many parties or things like that. Whereas with Bhangra, the proliferation has been in other forms, like fitness, which I don't really co-sign on.
I've taken one of those classes. I'm not even going to front.
And I think that the other parties like mine are actually in different cities, you know, and they're basically their own twist. But the idea is like it's a regular monthly Bhangra party, which happened in other cities, you know. And I think that is a direct influence. I mean, it depends on how broadly you define scene. A scene, like anything connected to the music, it is specific to that kind of cultural experience or whatever. So,
I think the reason we're talking about it is because this is something that we struggle with. Like,
there's no right answer. There's no,
there's
end
no right
time.
Answer.
Oh,
yeah, that's we're the
not,
truth.
Yeah, we're not, no, not even that there's a right answer. It's like this is something that is kind of like a open-ended changing question, you know.
Well, it's, or, it's
that's what we're hoping to explore here.
We're the first generation of South, of one of the, like, we're both first generation,
first or we would argue second gen.
Would you argue second gen?
Yeah, because that's the way it's defined. Is like, again, these are like somatic exercises. Like, some people call us second gen, and that's the term that's often used, second gen, even though you're born here. You know, so you're second gen because your parents are first. But sometimes within Korean, like some people are 1.5. So it's the way the term is often described as second gen.
So we're really the first generation born here.
Yeah, but you're still second gen.
No, that's but the larger point remains.
No, but the point just I'm saying is that we're new.
Yeah,
we're a new community. And so there's a lot of shifting. There's a lot of things that are new and. I guess we're trying to think how to, we're just young men trying to learn how to walk in this world and like how to honor our roots while moving forward and building, you know, because I'm not moving back to India.
No, of course.
That's not happening. Mm-hmm. But how do I honor the roots and the culture that I was raised in where it's being influenced by a very different culture in a very different land? And so that, I think that's what, one of the reasons that, for me, why we talk about South Asian community, it's like, well, maybe that's part of, and we talk a lot about on the podcast, if you've gotten a chance to listen, about cultural preservation and what are our roles and responsibilities. Do we have a role in that? Do we have a responsibility in that?
Well,
and some people have argued no, and some people have argued yes.
I mean, cultural preservation is a slippery slope. Because on the one hand, you know, you there's something about like heritage, tradition that you want to preserve or whatever. On the other hand, it can be, again, a very, like, you can sort of bring over some of the ills that that preservation sort of propagates. So, like, the idea of, like, okay, so we're in March, and there's a million holy parties happening.
Yeah.
Holy this, holy that, everywhere. Now, we could be lighthearted and say, eh, you know, whatever, it's a fun holiday, people throw colors and whatever. But I think it's... I would never do, I've, you know, full disclosure, I've DJed events that say holy. I wouldn't personally produce one or Diwali party because, you know, one could say, you know, innocently enough that, oh, whatever, you know, it's celebratory. For me, it feels exclusionary. So it's like where you, you know, I just feel like that is, you know, reifying the idea that India is Hindu. and that South Asian culture should be represented in this Hindu lens. And I think at this moment, and today in today's newsfeed, beef is outlawed in Maharashtra, you know? I think these are this kind of dictate of social order in a very particular way. I mean, I'm not really articulating it properly, but I just think, like, when you sort of use limited lens or particular religious things to sort of represent culture, it's dangerous, you know, for me. I don't feel comfortable with it, and I think that it sort of creates a hegemony, you know, the idea that India is Hindu. And I think that India is a very, or South Asia is, it's a very diverse place.
No, it's an incredibly complex.
And there's a lot of, you know, other groups there that, you know, I'm from my background is the one of the most privileged in from the region. It's like North Indian, Hindi speaking, you know, I'm not religious, but my parents are. So like, I'm part of that sort of like generic representation or the over-representation. And I don't want to like propagate that.
My last question for us for the day, because we have to bring this to a close. Don't you think that we're in the kind of the beautiful thing? We spoke with Dr. Varun Soni, who's the dean of religious life at USC.
I know him.
Right. He was talking about that we have one of the things that he was talking about is that with this newness becomes a chance, an opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
Wouldn't you say that some of the issues that you're talking about bringing, when you talk about bringing over culture and the ills that can be brought over, don't you think that we have a space where we can, because we're new, we can create a community? We can kind of create what it means to be South Asian American right now, because it hasn't been defined fully.
Wait, that's disregarding 30 years of people doing cultural work here. You're sort of saying that you're the first person to define South Asian culture.
No, I'm saying
that it's new. It's not that new.
But 30 years is relatively new to the argument of culture. So I'm not. It's changing, and it's evolving. I mean, we were just talking with Simanti about Hindi and how it's constantly evolving.
Right.
I mean, we're not at all sitting here, and definitely Akash and I are not sitting here saying that we're the ones doing it. Uh-huh. But that this we have as a community, it's evolving and it's going to change. The
and
next
culture,
generation is going
to
be very different as well.
To me, tradition doesn't exist, and culture keeps moving. So when you have Bhangra dance competitions, they're inventing culture as they do it. Are they preserving it? I think the minute you try to preserve something, you're creating something new. Just the act of preservation is creating something new. So a lot of times with Bhangra competitions, there's this idea of like tradition, right? And I've been criticized. I mean, I think that's where the insider-outsider feeling is around Bhangra. It's like, yeah, you know, there's some high praise for this party and like very traditional mainstream outlets. But, you know, like, I feel like there's not necessarily a deeper connection with like people. The whole like, is it real? Or because I don't speak Punjabi fluently and because I'm don't have access to certain like subsets of community. Like, I think that's that, like, those spaces, like, they kind of invent the idea of culture. And culture's moving. There's no, like, it's not static. It's, like, bringing over a culture or preserving it. Culture's moving in that space where it comes from as well. So it's constantly, like, it's culture to me, it's movement, and tradition is invention. So that's how
that's
I see it.
Some pretty interesting stuff for us to talk about.
Can I ask you one more personal question? Is you have, and this is what I think has made you successful, you have a streak of defiance in you, it seems like, where it's like, oh, I can't play this cab driver music? Fine, I'm going to play this music that you can't tell me I can't play, which we're kind of brought up as like, that's not a good thing. I don't know if that's a traditional South Asian thing or just the way we were brought up. Where did that come from that you're like, you know what, you tell me I can't do this, I'm going to do it?
I don't know. I'm an artist. I want to create what I want to create. I feel like that's I don't know.
Like, even political activism. For you, like, I see injustice, I'm going to stand up, I'm going to say something, which is, in a way, defiant. Like, you're telling, you know.
I think guys do whatever the hell they want all the time, and nobody reads it as defiance. And if a woman does it, all of a sudden, it's like defiance. I think that's a kind of a, you know,
I don't know if you're mishearing what he said. I think he's just asking, where was it I think for me, the reason to stand up for people was taught to me. There's a human impulse, but it also can be tamped down by a lot of society.
Like, there's times where I see something, a boss mistreating his employee, and then part of me is like, I should
say
something,
and
I don't.
I don't know. I mean, I just felt like I was being, you know, artistically repressed, and I try to find a space where I wasn't. So I think, like, as an artist, we have a responsibility to our work to, like, try to create the spaces that we want.
Which a lot of people, maybe even myself included, to a degree, wouldn't
then
have.
They're not artists, you know, they just, you know, like, you have to push something, you know, to create. You have to take a chance somewhere. You know, I think that's my personal opinion, and some, you know, it depends on the medium you're working in too. As a DJ, you're always negotiating what the audience wants and what you want them to want or what you want to get. And it's a fine balance. And you see bad DJs not know how to do it all the time. You know, like, you want to give people what they know on the dance floor, but you want to get them somewhere else too.
Right.
And people dance to what's familiar, what they know, their politics, their history, their comfort, you know, and what they perceive as good or bad music, which is highly subjective and based on who they are. So I think that, you know, as an artist, I felt repressed in those situations because I was an artist and I was giving directives. And I'll tell you, it's a very basic thing about DJing. Nobody likes to be told what to do or how to do their job. And people feel very entitled to tell DJs what to do their job, even right. In the midst of them doing it.
Right.
Please don't wave that cell phone in my face. And that's just, it's kind of unique to being a DJ. I just think that's what it is. And I think within the South Asian context, there's this sort of attitude of servitude and, like, you're providing a service and I can, like, make it come on faster. I mean, I've had people, like, give me motions to make the song faster or change it faster. I'm like, wow. There's, you know, and I think that that's where that comes from. Just like the idea of, like, trying to create, find a place, like an audience. I mean, I tried it and it worked. And if I had tried it and it hadn't worked or we didn't have people, I don't know what would have happened, you know? Yeah, it's just like being told, like, and it's happened to me in white clubs where I go and they, like, hire me. They don't really understand what I do. And then they want me to just water it down and play top 40 and, like, I mean, I've had such racist shit said to me, like, don't play this tribal music. I'm like, what the fuck? Are you serious?
Wow.
Yeah, it happens all the time. I mean, people are very opinionated about music and what is and isn't. I'm opinionated about it, you know? Like,
we haven't noticed.
Yeah. I mean, you know, in terms of, like, whatever, like, even my co-DJs, like, I'm not going to say it to them, but I'm like, you know, is it too early? Too, you know?
Right.
Trying to create a vibe, and we all have it in our heads, but I think that's just part of DJing or just part of art making, you know.
There you go. Cool.
Well, is there anything we love to have a space for you to plug anything that's going on, or if our audience can reach out, like, find you, or if you, are you on Twitter?
DJ Reka at DJ Reka everywhere.
At DJ Reka
everywhere, all forms. I do weekly show Bhangra and Beyond. Just Google it. And first Thursday of every month, based in Bhangra at La Poisson Rouge in New York City.
Beautiful. Well, guys, there's a lot for us to discuss, and I'm sure you guys have
fun editing that shit.
Very little editing happens, as you know.
Right.
Make sure, you know, hit us up. We're going to have a discussion in a couple days, so hit us up on Twitter and on Facebook.
And rate the podcast, subscribe, review, talk about us, good things, bad things. That's all. We welcome it all.
As always, I'm Arjun.
I'm Akash.
We'll catch you in a couple days.
God bless.